Hi, and welcome to Song Divers, an interview podcast about singer-songwriters.
We like to go deep in conversation with our favorite musicians in search of honest answers.
What are the ingredients of a great song?
What makes a songwriter tick?
Can a musician make a living these days?
Is Jason Isbell overrated?
What?
My name is Stefan.
And this is Ed.
And this week, we welcome a singer-songwriter that comfortably marries folk and soul.
Hey, this is Christopher James.
Christopher James is one of those artists whose songwriting is sometimes overshadowed by his own show-stopping vocals. And that is most definitely a compliment. The dude can write, and man, can he sing. Through well-received EPs and a brand new full-length album, Kindness Never Quits, Chris's songs have morphed from folky, sometimes ethereal Americana pop tunes into a sultry, soul-style Americana that gives us visions of an Amos Lee and Barry White collaboration. He's a pleasant mix of styles and inspirations. His black framed glasses give him a look of intelligent innocence, while his colorfully tattooed arms tell a story of vibrant expression. It's always a pleasure to hear Chris perform, and he's a lot of fun to speak with. We were glad to get a meaningful window of time with him, away from the green rooms of the Southeast Concert Circuit, where we usually, and always happily, cross paths. We hope you enjoy getting to know Christopher James. So Chris, where are you from?
Originally born in Bradenton, Florida. But when people ask, I usually say Sarasota, because they don't really know where Bradenton is, unless they go to Anna Maria and like, oh, I've seen that on a sign on my way to the beach. Yeah, so originally from Bradenton, Florida.
The main thing I think of when I think of Bradenton is Shake Pit.
Yeah, man. That is literally 5 minutes up the road from where I live right now.
Is it? Yeah.
And that is a dangerous 5 minutes.
Yeah. Ice cream, cheeseburgers.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
There's a couple of Bradenton staples that, like, unless you haven't lived there your whole life, you will have no idea that they're there. Yeah, there's this...
Give us the secrets.
Okay, so there's this burger place out towards the island. I can't remember what it's called now, so forgive me. But the grill is about 100 years old.
Oh, wow.
And it sounds gross. Never washed. Has the same original grease. Best
seasoning.
Burgers. Yeah, best burgers and hot dogs.
Grizz, man. You'll it's 100 years of grizz.
Yeah. Yeah, and then there's Councils, that's downtown Bradenton, and then they make a really, same kind of a thing. Burgers, french fries, shakes. Mm. I think that's just a Bradenton thing. We just love burgers and
so
shakes.
So you grew up as a foodie?
No. No, actually, I grew up, my sister and I lived with my mom, a single mom, and we kind of grew up relatively poor. Apartments, I remember my mom and I... The only food we were really, really acquainted with that we could call ourselves connoisseurs of was mac and cheese.
Mm.
I think we could tell the difference between boxed mac and cheese and Velveeta. And you know it's a good day when you got the Velveeta stuff and it's super creamy.
Hey, mac and cheese sommelier.
Oh, man. Yeah, man. I had to go all over the world to get that title.
Mm-hmm. And was your mom musical?
No, to a degree. I found out later that she played the flute. Because I found it in, like, a closet somewhere. I'm like, what is this magical instrument right here? And trying to play in it and terrible. And she told me the story about how she was in marching band and she was a cheerleader and all this other stuff and did the flute. I'm like, that's incredible. So nobody really in my family is musical, which is, I'm still the black sheep, I guess, of the family. Punk rock kid, also a musical kid.
So in terms of music in the household, was she listening to music? Like, where were you getting your music from, or were you?
The music vocabulary in the home was like Alice Cooper, Journey.
Yeah, I hear Alice Cooper.
Do you? Yeah. Mm-hmm. School's Out for the Summer.
Yeah.
I literally referenced for the new album.
Like, did you?
Oh, yeah. No.
Talking about Gullible.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, Hot for Teacher. I heard some of that.
That's not Alice Cooper, but you know, okay.
It's that same genre. Yeah.
But yeah, Journey. She was really into Journey. Goodness gracious, man. My dad was a big Zeppelin fan. Oh. He's the one who got me into Queen. So just kind of we did a lot of good classic rock in the household.
We thought you were going to say Marvin Gaye and Curtis Mayfield.
Oh, see, I found Marvin Gaye later on in life.
Yeah.
So when I was about 8 or so, I started mowing lawns for money around the neighborhood and stuff. And the very first thing I did with my newly acquired money was go and buy Boys to Men's Coolie High Harmony cassette.
Yes.
And I wore that thing out. Like, it literally would not play anymore. I played that thing so much. So, yeah. So, later on in life, about 8 or 9, I started finding myself into, like, the R&B sector of music.
Did you take a stab at singing that stuff?
No.
Like, would you sing along with it? Or?
Well, I mean, to a degree, an 8-year-old could sing End of the Road
right.
or I'll Make Love to You and understand what you're saying.
You don't know what you're singing.
No, I think at 8 you're still like, oh, girls have cooties, love is weird.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, End of the Road was my jam. Every time that song came out, I'm like, yes, I don't know what I'm singing, but I'm feeling this in my soul.
I'm picturing an 8-year-old in the quintessential, like, Chris Glasses with your current hair at 8.
Oh, man,
but
no
also
way.
With, like, the pumps and, like, you know, tube socks, mowing the lawn with, like, huge headphones on.
Well, okay, so if we could edit the image to Umbro everything and a bowl cut,
oh,
then we're good. We're pretty much narrowing down what Christopher looked like at 8 years old.
So you didn't retain any of those aesthetics then?
No. Well, I tried to bring them back, but... Uh-huh. No. The only thing that stuck was my Ninja Turtle collection. That's literally it.
Well, that's very, yes. That's legacy. Legendary.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It sounds like you were at least a responsible kid. Were you a good kid? Were you a bad kid? Athletic?
It depends
staying
on
out of
who,
trouble?
It depends on who you ask, I guess.
Well, I'm asking you.
I would say, meh. You know, I was a kid. I did get into athletics later on. When my stepdad and my mother got married, that's when we kind of came out of this really impoverished life into like, oh, okay, so this is kind of like what middle class is. You know, we're able to have our own rooms, and like sleeping with my mom in the same room, you know, for a couple of years. It gets old.
Mm-hmm.
So having the ability to do more things because we actually had stability, that's when I started getting into athletics. So I think I was maybe 10 or so, 10 or 11 when I started getting into baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And baseball was my heart. I was a huge Braves fan, like David Justice. And
oh, heck yeah. That
Marquise Grissom. Man, that team, that 89 to 94 team. Was,
yeah, man. Lemke, Lofton.
Yes.
Yeah, all those
yes.
guys.
Yes. Oh,
was I'm Klesko too, I think?
Yep.
Yep.
Mark Klesko.
Oh, yeah.
Man, Javier Lopez playing catcher. Tom Glavine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I still have,
we're the same generation.
A Greg Maddux. Yeah. I have a Greg Maddux jersey that I wear around the house all the time. It's just like, it's my comfort. But yeah, so I got into baseball and did fairly well. Tried to play some other sports and nothing really stuck like baseball, but I was still really athletic. I still ran, still put myself in, you know, in as much athletic situations as I could.
Mm-hmm.
When I graduated high school, I started getting into ultimate frisbee and dominated. I could say that humbly, but like I still love ultimate frisbee. It's a lot of fun. I hurt my shoulder when I was there, like tore rotator cuff kind of a thing. Like I played to play.
I was going
to
say, most of the people I know that play ultimate frisbee do end up with some type of injury.
Yeah, it's not like a safe sport. Well, I mean, it's a fun sport, like to play with friends. But like, if you take it too seriously, it's definitely one of the things where it's like you're, you know, you're 60 years old and you've got a limp because
right.
you played ultimate frisbee.
So it sounds like you're staying out of trouble at least.
To a degree, yeah. I mean, I would still get in trouble in the neighborhood. I got in one little fight. My mom got scared. Sorry. I had to do that. That just sounded like I was starting to sing the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. My apologies. No. But yeah, I would get in trouble in the neighborhood. I would, gosh, I can't believe I'm saying this. I would light things on fire.
Pyro.
Yeah. Just, although I had this fascination
with
fire.
Not animals.
No. Never, never, never. There
always humans.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, he caught me.
Yeah.
No, like I lit the side of my fence on fire on accident. I say that to cover my butt.
Accidentally on purpose.
Accidentally right. on purpose. And, oh my gosh, I can't believe this is coming out of my mouth right now.
Don't want to have a talk with your mom?
No, we're grown people here. Like, it's fine. Actually, what's funny is I told my stepdad later, and I think he knew because much like, you know, you have controlled burns in certain areas to reinvigorate the nutrients in the soil and stuff. Mm-hmm. Same thing happened with my fence. Like this moss started growing in the areas that were burned. And he's like, what's happening here? Yeah. He's like, did you do anything to the fence? I'm like, no.
Why would of you course, think that?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, he was hip to what I was doing.
Well, so, and on that topic there, so you're getting into your early teens here, mm-hmm. rolling into high school. So are you just exclusively Boys to Men at this point? Like, what is becoming important? Like, where's music really starting to come in?
So this is where, there's so many.
And no
influences.
One's
going
to judge you if it's just Boys to Men.
And
like,
I think,
through the first 25 years of your
if
life.
If that was it, I would just wear that as a badge at all times. I would meet people and just say, hey, you know what? I grew up in just with Boys to Men. That's mm-hmm. it. Can you tell?
And they'd say, baby, 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 baby,
mama. Anyway, so. My musical vocabulary, as I started entering into like my teen years and stuff, my stepdad actually was the one who introduced me to a lot of other vintage style music. He showed me Jerry Lee Lewis and Johnny Cash. He showed me Roy Orbison. I loved Roy Orbison. I don't know why, but he was like one of my favorites. Mm-hmm.
He's one that like just keeps getting better for me. Every time I go back and listen to Pretty Woman, I hear something new, and I'm just like, God. Damn, this thing rocks.
And the
it's
dude,
like this balance of tenderness and like high drama. You know,
yeah.
Like
and
this,
you could
like,
hear it in his voice. There was tension in his voice, but it was so subtle too. Right. Like he could sing The Phone Book and you would be like, yeah, I'm in love with this guy.
Oh my God. I mean, yeah, it was just the power in his vocals and the range. And it was so unique, obviously mm-hmm. extremely unique to him. And so many people try to emulate it after him. But to your point, just the dynamics in that song alone are amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So amazing.
So I had the influence from my stepdad, just this really wonderful collection of vintage music. Boys to Men, started listening to like Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg, Warren G. But then on the other flip side, I was listening to like Garth Brooks, The Hits, like Standing Outside the Fire would make me cry. I would literally be like, oh my gosh, Standing Outside the Fire, and just cry listening to this song.
And there's the fire again, your fascination with.
That's probably what it was. It was just hitting something deep within me.
Mm-hmm. I just want to light a match right now.
Most of the emo kids of our generation weren't being, you know, brought to emotions through Garth Brooks. I think it was generally like the emo bands.
Oh, totally. 100%. But it came about. So emo came about a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
Like I had to go through the punk rock stuff first before I got to the emo stuff.
Right. Right.
So shortly after kind of sifting through what I wanted, cause I was still an athletic kid. I got hurt in playing a sport and I just kind of stopped playing in general.
It was ultimate frisbee, wasn't it?
Obviously. No, indoor soccer. But so where I was living, around me, I had a couple of friends who were in this band. And so every day they would talk about being in this band. This is, by the way, this is the segue where we go into Christopher's musical life.
Yes.
Okay.
We were going to go there. But
cool. No, that's okay. This is just a natural tree.
You can see my notes from over there?
There's a mirror behind you.
Okay.
There were some friends of mine in the neighborhood that were musicians. There was a bass player that lived right behind me. Singer guitar player lived literally just up the road. And one of my best friends at the time, Ryan Willis, was a guitar player that literally lived maybe a half a mile away from my house. But we all rode the same bus and they would just talk about music the whole time. Ryan and I would literally be in the back singing Rage Against the Machine, Evil Empire for like front to back until we got to school. And I used to drum on everything. Just being ADD and a kinetic person, I just needed to tap on things. And they assumed, without me saying anything, that I was a drummer. And I never told them anything different.
Well, you can understand why now, having been a musician.
100%.
Yeah.
And they're like, obviously this guy's a drummer.
I also, too, have to say, I'm just like shuddering at it. So Ed's wife is a teacher. And I'm just thinking of, if I were a teacher and I knew all the kids were being dropped off after listening to Rage Against the Machine on the way to school, like just getting just revved up and handed to me, like, oh no.
Yeah. Oh, I'd put in my resignation right there. Yeah. Nah, I'm good.
Yeah. At least it was tasteful music, but still.
Yeah. Being, yeah. So they asked me just straight up one day on the bus, hey man, you wanna be in our band? I was like, oh, that would, yeah. Yeah. Why do you ask? I was like, well, obviously you're a drummer. I'm like, yeah, let's be in a band.
Fake it till you make
it. That sounds like, dude, you have no idea. So a month later, talking about being in this band, never touching a drumstick in my whole damn life. They're like, hey, we're going to have to practice. We have a show on Friday. And I'm like, oh, it's Tuesday. And I'm like, okay, well, let me, what do you want to do? How do you guys practice? I'm like, well, can we come over to your house since you have a drum set? Let's come over to your house and we'll practice in your garage. I'm like, well, I'll have to obviously ask my parents. So mm-hmm. I'll be right back. We had no cell phones or beepers or anything like that. Like we had like phones. I don't know why I said beepers, like beep, beep, beep. Hey, I can play in your band.
Well, yeah, we didn't, you're not a doctor.
143. So, yeah. So anyway, so I went to my stepdad and I'm like, look, I did something really dumb. And I told him and he goes, yeah, that was really dumb. But let's go and get you a drum set. And I was like, oh, you've got to be kidding. So
you're like, you have no idea how much other dumb stuff I'm going to do.
Yeah. Like, I've got a list of things, man.
I told my friends we had a horse.
Can we make that happen?
Yeah.
So we go down to... what is now Sam Ash. It was Thoroughbred Music out in Sarasota. And we picked up this $250 drum set with cymbals. And it was like made out of cardboard. It was legit the cheapest thing there. But it was this incredible extension of kindness from my stepdad. And I come to find out that he was a drummer during this whole thing. He was a drummer when he was a kid. So of course he's going to go, yeah, let's get you some drums.
Yeah.
And he sat down, we came back to the house, set him up in the garage, and he taught me four on the floor. And he let me practice until like 2 o'clock in the morning. And then the next day we had practice with everybody there. We learned one song and we played this really crappy church lock-in. And that was the literal start to my musical life. I fell in love with drums and that was it.
So you got a drum set on Tuesday.
Yeah.
First gig Friday.
Friday.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
How much did you play that night?
Oh, I played one song, but then I would play like Georgia the Jungle, like on my toms. Like super, super easy. Mm-hmm. But like, I don't know. It was just the experience of sitting down behind a drum set and being with other people creating something. That was like... this power and this experience I had never thought I could be a part. Like other people could make music, but like that is so bizarre and obtuse to me.
Mm-hmm. Did your band have a name?
Yes. It was called Selah, which is, yeah. So we were a Christian band, which is funny because I wasn't really a Christian at the time or anything like that. And they were like, yeah, Selah. Like, it means, it's like what they say at the end of the Psalms, like after each Psalm. And I guess it meant like, amen. I'm like, oh, okay, cool, whatever. Like, I'm going to go back to my Rage Against the Machine now.
Yeah.
Like, kind of a thing. And so, yeah, it's funny how that group influenced kind of like the rest, I don't want to say the rest of my life, but influenced that time in my life and that progression of who I was as a person, because I was just getting into punk music at the time. My stepsister showed me a Bad Religion's Generator album, and I was like, this is the most amazing thing ever. Bad Religion will still be like my number one, even though they're like there's much better music out there. Musically, there's just something in me that's like, yeah, Bad Religion, number one band, always.
Nostalgia, yeah. Man. There's something for it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that rabbit hole brought me down to like Rancid and ska music, and I started falling in love with ska music, trying to drum like a really fast punk rock drummer. And that's kind of where I went. Band broke up. We started another band.
Same guys?
Nope, different guys.
Okay.
Different guys. Actually, Ryan, my friend Ryan Willis, he and I went to this new band, and they were a ska band called Exit 33, and it was like, it wasn't even a ska band. Like, it was a ska band without horns. So, like,
yeah, right.
Which I don't know how we can constitute being a ska band, but we were in our minds, we were.
A lot of upstrumming and.
Oh, yeah. Unk, 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 unk.
We'll whatever. Find horns later.
Yeah, exactly. So, we ended up finding horns, but they were awful. They were just terrible horns. They literally just, it sounded like Casio keyboard horns.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was it. That band turned into a, like another punk rock band, like an actual punk rock band, and called Disturbing Peace. And we did some stuff with that. We,
and what age were you at that time?
That's, I was in high school by then.
Okay.
So I think I was eighth grade or freshman year in high school when I actually started drumming. So this stuff kind of took place within the first to second year of my high school. So I think late sophomore, that's when Disturbing Peace started, and we just started doing like more stuff. So we played a lot more clubs. We started playing with a lot of other bigger bands. Thought we could take a couple of stabs at being like a touring punk rock band on the weekends. So we tried that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot of fun, like passing out after, not really passing out, but mm-hmm. just playing so hard and so fast that you just need to lay down was the most incredible energy I'd ever encountered.
Endorphin rush.
Oh man, it was incredible. It was incredible.
Especially as a drummer.
Oh, I mean, yeah. Yeah.
The catharsis of just hitting heads like that for a while, especially if you're playing punk.
Absolutely. Well, that was like, I tried to go as fast and as hard as possible. Like, if I could break sticks, there were a couple of times where I like bloodied knuckles and mm-hmm. stuff because you're in it so hard that you're not really paying attention to where your hands are at, you know, when it comes to your snares or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, man, it was pretty nuts. A lot of bloodied shows.
It's interesting. I think of at least people of our generation, the generational like kind of bedrock curriculum of music, you know, and the stuff that like binds those generations, and to still end up like, I do nothing like that when I songwrite, and certainly neither do you.
Oh no, not at all. I think I tried to write a punk song one time and I'm like, oh, this is dumb.
Yeah.
I'm dumb.
Maybe we just weren't angry enough.
No, obviously I just wasn't mad enough at the government. Well, that's then, then.
Yeah.
I could probably write a pretty good punk song
now. Come back to your punk roots now.
Yeah, like, man. Yeah. Why not?
Well, Kindness Never Quits would be a really like sarcastic name for a punk album. You know,
it would. It would be a pretty... Yeah. Well, maybe that's...
Instead, and I'm assuming, we'll get to it, but I'm assuming it's actually very sincere.
Yeah, it is. Yes. Yeah, genuinely.
So when did you start to write for yourself, and when did you start to shift into guitar? Because we haven't heard anything about guitar at this point.
No, not at all. So college is when I started playing guitar. And so much in the same vein that I learned drums, I kind of taught myself how to play drums. I taught myself how to play guitar, which is why I'm terrible at guitar.
You're not, by the way.
You're very kind.
I was just going to say, it is important that we note that for everybody as you're answering this question at this point in the episode. Definitely worth listening because you are a good player. Like, you have an obvious comfort and taste, and there's certain things that you can do on a guitar that you can tell when people get it and people that don't.
Language.
You know? Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah. So it was college, actually, that kind of forced me to learn guitar because I couldn't bring my drums to college. They wouldn't let me have them in my dorm room. So I had to sell
what
my drum set.
An awful college.
I know.
Just the man holding you down.
Man. Well, yeah, the college is pretty shitty. If I'm being honest. Language. But yeah, so I brought an applause with me, mm-hmm. which was like a jank ovation,
mm-hmm.
and tried to teach myself how to, you know, how to actually play. And there were a couple of people in the dorm area that like could play super, super good. I will say this was a Christian college that I went to. So the musical vocabulary at the Christian college was very non-existent.
Three chords.
Oh, dude. A, C, D, or EAB.
I spent some time in, I was in contemporary worship for about 12 years.
Oh, yeah, okay.
My theory is, and I've never heard anybody talk about this, and I've never asked anybody about this, but my theory is that it has to be as simple as possible so that anybody in the church can play it around a campfire.
I understand that.
You know?
I can get that to a degree.
And I think that's what it is.
And because the music was awful. But no, it had to deal with the worldview of a congregation setting. It was very hive-minded, but right. Not necessarily in the best interest of... It was very contradictory. It was like, let's put out, you know, stuff that is excellent, but let's use the simplest of languages. Mm-hmm. And it's like, let's just drone on E for 5 minutes right. and repeat a phrase that whole time, and we'll just sing within the key. Mm-hmm. And that was considered to be what a contemporary worship song.
Right.
And there's, while I think that has its place, you know, and in no way, shape, or form would I ever tell anybody not to believe whatever their worldview is. Now, I would challenge them to, you know, try listening.
Look outside.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's always good to look outside whatever your initial circle is. But yeah, just for me, it was a very kind of contradictory experience playing contemporary worship.
Well, that's really interesting. So, and we'll get back to the guitar
piece
of that. But I think, you know, this is a important bedrock of a lot of people, like your belief system and how it affects your songwriting and how it affects your worldview. So I went to a Catholic high school. I was not raised Christian or Catholic or anything. Ended up at a Catholic high school, and I was really fortunate that every year you had to take a religion class. And the first year was basically learning the Bible, but like a book of literature. So just, you should know what's in here.
Yeah.
The second year was world religions. And that teacher basically started the class by saying, hey, you may all be Catholic. Some of you may be Jewish. Who cares? You're going to learn about all these worldviews, and you may find that something just moves you.
Yeah.
And the same thing. You should know about these because Catholicism is not the only religion,
yeah.
you know, and that was, I am so grateful for that class because it was very much, and it still has affected my view of how I feel about religion and faith and all those things. So, you know, as we kind of talk about that, I think it's really interesting. You were at a Christian college.
Yeah.
That's when you're starting to develop your guitar playing chops.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about, hey, so why, like, you got there with an ovation. Where'd mm-hmm. that come from? Were you getting lessons? Were you self-taught?
No.
And then are you starting to write?
I love it. So I bought the ovation before I went to college because I knew I wasn't able to take my drum set. So it was $199, I think. So I was like, this is the cheapest one in the store. Yeah, you're probably right. So I bought the guitar and I took it with me. But I was listening to a lot of Dashboard Confessional at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Like Swiss Army Romance had come out. Man. And I'm like, oh, my God. Yeah, this is just my life.
Yeah.
And so I just dadgad the guitar. And that's how I kind of learned the guitar. I learned guitar on 3 strings. And the rest were like, I'm not touching the rest of them. No way. Like,
for the non-music listeners, he's talking about tuning down the low E string.
Yeah.
So D-A-D are those top, which is why he said dad gets.
Yeah.
So. Mm-hmm. Oh, and the high E.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're tuning the high E.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was just really easy for me because not knowing formation, chord formations, or even voicings for that matter, like dadgad was this easiest way to write songs. Mm-hmm. And I've always been, to reverse a little bit, I've been a huge poetry fan, like pretty much the majority of my life. Like I used to watch Def Poetry Jam all the time. Like anytime it came on, I'm watching that stuff.
Heck
and it
yeah,
was
man.
Just, it just was so vitriol, but also so cathartic in their delivery and, you know, the art itself. I'm like, oh, poetry is incredible. So I took the guitar and really just learned how to do open tuning songs. From there, the old singer from my punk band, who has a beautiful singing voice, he and I just did acoustic songs. I would not sing.
Was he at the college with you?
No.
Okay.
No. But I would go home on the weekends mm-hmm. to do laundry, and we would just get together on like
and
a Friday.
And commit blasphemy.
Yeah. Obviously. And Friday, Saturday, we would get together someplace, sometime, and we would just sit and write songs. And he was a great lyricist, great songwriter. And so he would sing. I would write the songs, and that's kind of what we would do. We played a couple of coffee shops, but nothing really past that. But it introduced me to attempting to sing, because I would not in any way, shape, or form. I was just too I was too afraid to get myself out there. But yeah, it was a good introduction. I actually kind of learned how to sing, if we're going to fast forward just a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, no, sorry, pardon.
No, you can fast forward.
Well, so when I was still within the church, and I was trying to write songs for the church. Mm-hmm. And that was like my introduction to actually writing songs. Mm-hmm. And it was just, it kind of failed. There was no real progress within those songs, but it gave me an avenue of practice. And but writing for myself, it was never looked on as if it were a positive thing. It was, I think I tried to play, I played one show as a solo guy, and it was like, no, this can't be a thing. Just
this
from people.
Is yourself?
No, this is from people in my life.
Okay.
They were like, no, this is a little too uncomfortable. Like, I played at a bar, and they're like, no, you can't play at a bar. You're a Christian. You're not supposed to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, you're within the heathens.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of a thing. And I'm like, well, I really enjoyed it. But I was
they're
also.
They're like, exactly.
Yeah. But I was also not, I was not confident in myself as a person. Like, I was still in this very uneasy, tumultuous area. A lot of things.
Late teens, early 20s?
No, dude. Early 20s. Or we'll say early 20s. Mm-hmm. I was still trying to figure out who I was as a person. At 36, I am much more aware of myself as a human being. I just didn't. I let the influence of other people dictate what I felt was most important for my life.
Do you think that was particularly because of the Christian environment?
100%. 100%. Because I trusted them. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, all right, obviously they know what's best for me. And the posture of Christianity, while I said it earlier, I will not in any way, shape, or form dictate how a person believes. It's a belief of self-neglect. Mm-hmm. It will tell you less of you and more of Jesus.
Your Christian community. And
absolutely.
Jesus, yeah.
It's like you are not the point of your life. Mm-hmm. And that was very much a posture that I took. So I neglected myself supremely. Moving on and actually figuring out how to sing was kind of on accident, because I would do voices and stuff. Mm. Like, I would do Mickey Mouse.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And all of these.
It's a pretty good Mickey.
Thank you very much. I've been trying for years. Disney has not.
Yeah, don't
called
come
me
after
back.
Us. Yeah.
Finally,
just bleep
it.
That out. Yeah. It'll just be like a long bleep. Uh-huh. And so I just kind of found myself singing by myself, and I was able to like hold a tune. I'm like, okay, it's almost like you're mimicking in a way. Mm-hmm. So I would kind of mimic the singers that I was listening to. Then I started doing contemporary worship. I would sing on the contemporary worship bands, and I would kind of mimic the songwriters that the songs we were singing. And that's kind of how I found that I could sing. It wasn't until I tried finding my voice that I was getting a lot of pushback from the church, which it's so interesting. The more I talk about this,
you no longer sounded like David Crowder.
Well, it was,
and because you were making women feel faint.
Well, there's a part of that that was in the, you don't want to like keep it easy. Because I would do like a run just because I felt like that's what needed to be there musically. And I would get pushback like, no, don't do that. You need to keep it. Mm-hmm. Keep it bottom shelf.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Keep it so that everybody can do it. Mm-hmm. Also, we need to make sure that we're not causing ladies to stumble.
Right.
Kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Like, well, all right.
Well, so there's some important things in there.
No, yeah,
but one of the things is you're talking about mimicking voices.
Yeah.
If you're one of those fortunate people that you can hear and you have muscle memory, right? I mean, because that's so much of singing, any instrumentation, but especially singing. But then you talked about doing a run.
Yeah.
So you had no formal training. You're just, so who were you, like, who were you being influenced by that's, like, that you even knew what a run was, right?
Well, Roy Orbison.
Well, I mean, I was leaning pretty heavily on the music that I listened to back in the day. I think at the time I was listening to.
Because Dashboard.
No.
Though it plays. Just and
yell.
I, exactly.
Yeah.
In, you know, in an important way that
absolutely.
Was a huge part of a
absolutely.
Lot of people.
And he's still doing amazing
it,
stuff.
As he should be. But no, you know, no vocal runs
yeah.
of.
You're not hearing him do like.
Yeah. Like, we'll hear you do in a little bit. Yeah.
We'll see. We'll see. But so I was listening to City Color, City in Color, mm-hmm. and Dallas Green actually does a lot. He's got a really soulful voice for you know, the singer of Alexis on Fire, or yeah, something like that, or whatever. I can't remember the band. But
we don't fact check on this podcast.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm just going to start making stuff up now. Yeah. On the Dog and Pony Show. He's he's a great dude. So there's another guy, David Ramirez, that I just started listening to, and he would do these really interesting, subtle runs. And he's a songwriter from Texas, and I still hold him as one of the best songwriters of today because the man can paint some brilliant word pictures. But he would do these subtle runs, and his note choices were just really, really interesting. And so that influenced kind of how I started singing too in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, doing the runs in church, no bueno, dude. Mm-hmm. That'll get you off the team, apparently.
So you're doing these sultry runs in church. And you're writing. So it sounds like this is around that time you start to shift out of like questioning that feeling of community, or I shouldn't say that feeling of community, but that specific community, Christian community. Mm-hmm. And when do you shift out, and what's your first song that you write that is not a Christian influence or for the, you know?
I love that. Thank you for that question. The first song that I wrote as myself, and it's funny that I word it that way because I wrote songs before, but
as Christopher James.
As Crow. Can I copyright that? That's amazing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, as Christopher James.
Yeah.
I wrote songs, but this was like my heart on a page.
Self-expression.
Yeah. And it was right before my son's first birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And it's his influence that started it.
So that's an important thing. We shouldn't skip over that.
Sure, please.
So sounds like some important stuff took place in your life.
One or two things.
Yeah. So while you're in the church, it sounds like, because you're shifting out, you're censoring. Tell us a little bit about that time, because that's an important thing. I haven't experienced fatherhood.
No, it's okay.
We've had some writers on. We had JT Brown on recently.
Yeah, man.
He just had Maverick, his son.
Yeah. That whole, watching him do that is just the most... Yeah, I can't help, like, you can see right now.
Yeah,
I just can't, you can't help
back,
but to
right?
see. Yeah,
yeah,
man.
Yeah. Chris is, well, he hasn't stopped smiling, but he's smiling larger now.
Because
all old, teeth. Yeah. Just all
how
teeth.
Old are you? You have a son, I know.
I do. My youngest just turned 3 yesterday.
Yeah, okay.
And my oldest will be 7 on Halloween, mm-hmm. which is the greatest birthday ever.
That is a good birthday.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the church, get married, and then...
And you met through church?
Yeah, we actually met through church.
Okay.
Lived a couple of years as, you know, non-children people, just uh-huh. married people.
Unfertile husband and wife.
Yeah. And it was just one of these, like, I bought a dog kind of a thing, you know, trying to, like, establish a home.
Got a grill?
Yeah. No, I didn't get a grill. Oh. No, I got a George Foreman grill, okay. So that doesn't necessarily
yes.
count. But
the practical American
it just
dream.
Felt... now this there are a lot more. It's funny because before this, you texted me, get ready to dive deep, and I'm like, are you sure you want to dive deep? Because there are some really deep things within these years. Like I said before, I was very self negligent mm-hmm. in a worldview, and in this time, I was dealing with a lot of insecurities. Body dysmorphia comes up. I was like, it would take me 45 minutes to leave the house if I felt comfortable enough to leave the house in the clothes that I was wearing.
Hmm.
Because I would just kind of go through this moment of, no, man, I'm just not comfortable in my skin. I'm bigger than, I mean, because that's what body dysmorphia does. Your perception of yourself in the mirror is completely askew. And so I would have these panic attacks running back and forth, and it stemmed from a lot of things within the relationship that I had. But it was also just there were things within myself that I didn't confront or work through.
And I need to ask you, like,
please.
Diagnosed dysmorphic?
To a degree.
Okay.
Not clinically, no.
And I say that for listeners because everybody's got some self-criticism
yeah.
to some degree,
yeah.
right? And so for somebody that has never been through anything like that or has never been around anybody like that, like it is truly another degree of of perceiving yourself to the 100%. Point where a lot of the exercises for somebody that has body dysmorphia, one of them, for example, is you think you are, it's like a small dog that doesn't realize that they're not a lot, you know,
yeah.
that, or they think they're a gigantic dog and they, you know, run up. But what therapists will generally have you do is trace yourself and then sit back and look at it and realize how small it is.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. And put things in perspective, like exactly. Put things up against the tracings.
And, yeah. But it's important because that is something that a lot of people struggle with it. And I have friends that have gone through it. Some people very close to me that are dealing with it. And then other people that are friends of mine, they're like, they just don't get it. You know, yeah. And they're like, oh yeah, well, we all think we weigh too much. I'm like, it's not quite the same thing.
It's one thing to think you're bigger than you are. It's another thing for your mind to play a trick on you and to actually see yourself, like visualize yourself.
Right.
It's completely different. So
it's like Shallow Hal, but more of a horror movie.
Yes. Yeah. If Shallow Hal were to be directed by, I don't know, M. Night Shyamalan.
Right.
Yeah. So I didn't realize I was going through this until after the fact. Talking with a couple of people a couple of years later, they were like, this is exactly what it sounds like. And they would ask me questions. It was either yes or no. So self-diagnosis to a point, but I'm not going to claim like any clinical diagnosis. But going through these insecurities and trying to work through these particular things, being self-negligent, it felt like the next step to save myself to a degree is to have a kid. Like, and I know that there's a bit of, it kind of feels morbid, like, and selfish to say that out loud.
Mm-hmm.
To save oneself, you need to bring another person into the world.
That's really interesting in so many ways, you know. But for me, you know, when I think about children, my stance on it generally has been like when you love someone so much that you just want more of them in the world.
Oh, I love that.
And that's legit. I really feel that way because I think that there are a lot of reasons to have children. You just named another one,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But some of that is like you're now loving yourself a little bit too there.
Oh, man.
Then you have more of you in the world.
And thank you. Like, I genuinely appreciate what you just said. And my kid is 100% himself, but he's me. Like, he's so me, it's gross. Like, oh my gosh. Like,
you're talking about the older one,
because he's
a little more developed and you start
absolutely.
To see more and more.
Absolutely. Yeah. And to be honest, he did save me. Like, he forced me to look at myself. My relationship with my own dad is not very good. You know, and having a great example in my stepdad to lean on helped in kind of carving out who I was as a father. But Kieran, overall, he's the guy who taught me how to be a dad. Like, he loved me even when I, and that's kind of where the first song came from. The first song was My Heart Wasn't Ready. And it's just an honest, I wasn't ready to have a kid. My heart was not ready to hold this kid, because you feel like the most powerful being on the face of the planet to this child.
And it's another, to me, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it's like another dimension of love once you have a child.
Oh, yeah.
It's like it opens up.
Yeah.
It's a new meaning.
Mm-hmm. Your expression of love, too. Like, because we kind of self-categorize ourselves as humans. That's just a part of what we do. We are compartmentalized creatures. And so we will characterize ourselves in a particular fashion. And then something happens, like a child, and that character shatters because you now are experiencing parts of yourself that you didn't know you had.
Right.
Because you're having to care and love and nurture another being.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I never thought I wanted kids because of my relationship with my dad. And here comes this little kid, and I'm like, I cannot imagine my life without you. Like, I still think, and actually, so the moment he was born, I had this surreal moment and thought of, oh, yeah, you've always been here. Like, I know this is your first, this is your introduction to actual life, like right here outside the womb, but you have always been here. And it was just this unreal moment of familiarity with this person. But yeah, so to go back to the song, that's what the song's about. Just coming to the conclusion of, oh, this is a real thing. I love you. I wasn't ready. But I'm going to do my damnedest to be the best dad that I possibly can. And so that was the introduction. I think that was like a Friday that I wrote that. I had like a bottle of Malbec at like 2 o'clock in the morning. And, but that weekend, like more songs just poured out. I think by Sunday I had 4 songs. I had what is the Movement EP that's posted up online.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the literal introduction. Now, what was interesting there is going from, hey, I wrote these 4 songs. I really am in love with these 4 songs. I listen to them now and I'm kind of cringy,
mm-hmm.
but then I'm not.
Oh, you should hear some of the, because we always ask guests, like, what was your first song?
Yeah.
Would you share that with us? And nobody's even close to My Heart Wasn't Ready.
Oh,
oh yeah. Yeah.
Some of them are just
I
so kind of
lucked out. Like, yeah. Well, that was like a 5-minute
Velvet
song.
Velvet Cocoon,
too.
I believe is what JT said.
Oh, man. What did he say?
Velvet Cocoon.
Oh, Velvet Cocoon.
I believe that was, yeah.
Was Steve Connolly, something like Uranian Overlords or something like that. Like,
yeah. Oh, my gosh. That's amazing.
A lot of drugs there.
No, that's okay. It makes sense.
So you're going through a life transformation, which is important. But now you've got this set of songs. So now you're confronting yourself, as you just said, and now you're starting to think about playing out something that intimate is a much different experience than playing a cover or playing Christian worship that everybody's basically has to enjoy.
Exactly.
Because they're all Christians
around you,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
So and talk they have a little bit about praise. That experience. So now you've got these songs and you're like, I need other people to hear these.
Yeah. Well, okay. So that was kind of a big leap because I found myself neglecting the songs and my love and appreciation and want to move forward with these songs. And just write more songs. Like within that first year, I think I wrote like 200 songs. And not having a place
to... Did you say 200 songs?
Yeah. Woo. I wrote every day, like without fail. Like the memo section in my phone was just like, what are you doing right now? Like, why all of a sudden this activity? Trying to move forward with these songs, I found myself trying to make excuses for myself not to do them. Like, oh yeah, yeah. I'm leaning back on what was told to me just, you know, a year, 2 years prior. It's like, oh yeah, it's not important. It's not important. But it was important to me. And I had to come to terms with that. And I had to put myself forward in that manner and be brave enough to actually go after the thing that I wanted. And I think what pushed me over that line was looking at my kid and saying, because I would hold him every night and he would fall asleep on my chest and I would be talking to him as if he could understand me at a 1-year-old and saying, you know, whatever it is in your life that you want to do, I am behind you 100%. Like, you have no bigger cheerleader in your corner than myself. Like, whatever you dream, let's do it. It's going to be great. But then I caught myself afterwards going, why am I not doing that? It's one thing to say to somebody,
mm-hmm.
this is what you can do. It's another thing to show someone what they can do. So that was pretty much what pushed me over. It's like I have to also now be an example to my kid. The thing, I was lucky enough to have friends who had a coffee shop that would let me just kind of randomly on like a Wednesday go and play a couple of tunes just to
test the waters.
Yeah, man. And
was
it was
in Bradenton.
Yeah, this was in Bradenton. It was called Latte Luna. It is no longer there, unfortunately. But it was a great coffee house, great vibe and staff. But they would let me come and play and getting the response while it was good, and it satiated that, like, you know, that confidence in myself that I needed to keep going. It was also just a great learning opportunity for me behind the microphone, not as a singer who's singing these contemporary worship songs at a church that he is now wavering in his belief, but standing behind a microphone in a coffee house in front of complete strangers,
mm-hmm.
who are not forced to enjoy what is being played.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have the opportunity to either get up and leave, go to the manager and ask for the sound to be turned down, mm-hmm. request, you know, God knows what, it's Freebird. Yeah. That was the whole introduction and from start to finish. And then from there, it's just progressed into writing as many songs as I possibly can.
What would you say? Well, before I ask a little deeper question, one of the questions we always ask every guest, especially you're talking about writing 200 songs, are you a lyrics first, music first, or the actual front runner of our episodes, title first writer?
Oh, wow. Title first.
Thank That's you. What yes.
People say that. Yeah.
No way. Yeah. That blows my mind.
Right?
Well,
I mean, I think I get it because it kind of gives you a topic.
When you start thinking about it.
If you think about a title.
Yeah, it's like writing to a prompt.
Yeah, absolutely. You're like, it's like writing to a prompt.
Mm-hmm.
That is so funny. So, like I said before.
Or as Danny Scordato said, once you have a title, then the song writes itself.
Yeah, you just, you play it. Yeah, you go to the relative minor and.
I've been doing this wrong my whole life.
Yeah.
So. Like I said before, I'm a poetry guy, so writing has always been a cathartic art for me. So I write and write and write and write. But starting to...
Is that a mechanism for... It's like a therapeutic mechanism where you're like, I just need to get what's inside of me out.
Yeah.
Like and then sometimes it's like, hey, that part that just came out, that's lyrical.
So it's both and. I think sometimes I'll come up with a progression that I really, really like, or if I find like a chord that I am just... vibing with so much. I'm like, I love this sound and this feel, this tension, where this movement. So sometimes I'll come up with a progression that I really, really like, or sometimes it's, you know, it's the lyric that drives the song. You know, it's like, I really like this topic. Let's kind of move forward with it. Does it feel like a minor song? Does it feel like a major song that we just sing depressing lyrics over top? But I actually saw a video about a year and a half ago of a acquaintance of mine in Orlando, and he does this thing where he will just play and scat over top of it. He has no real form, really, other than kind of what he's playing. So if he finds a progression that he really, really, really likes, he'll keep playing it over and over again, and he'll just kind of scat over top to see where the melody might be and where the syllables land within that melody, and then he'll see if something naturally pops up in what he is scatting. Like, if he almost says a word, he'll go back again and he'll say the word.
And he's doing this live, like as part of a show?
No.
Oh, I
wish.
Like,
that'd be cool.
Yeah, you wouldn't have to practice ever.
Yeah, no. No, he does this as he's sitting in his room, like as a songwriting technique. But man, live, that would be cool.
Yeah, that's like that's just a total scam.
Yeah. But a lot of the songs on the new record, they're both and. They're either lyrics first or like Too Soon, Too Late. That was a very much kind of a scat song. Like, I had this idea of like falling in love too soon. Like, our relationship with love is just, you never know if it's too soon or if it's a bit too late.
But would you say the music was there first?
The idea of music was there.
Okay.
Like, I just had a feel, like I wanted it to feel like an old Otis Redding song.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just had that in mind as I was starting to play, and it just kind of came out of all that. It's really interesting. I found the video of, because sometimes I'll either record like a memo or I'll do like a video and I'll record it as I'm playing it,
mm-hmm.
just as I'm trying to figure out the song. And I saw the video the other day and I'm like, oh my gosh, I remember this. Like, it sounds completely different than what it sounds like now on the record. But yeah.
Well, it sounds great on the record.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's the whole process was cool.
Well, we haven't done a tune yet. You want to knock one out for us?
I can, yeah.
Let's maybe hear that one.
I've memorized latitude and longitude. I'm tethered tied to you. Something burned like a fire in the belly of our bone. Lightning strike in the midnight shone. Just enough light to show I'm not alone. And I should have known. I should have known, 'cause it's too soon to be true. It's too late to be you. It's too soon to be true. Yeah. Lingers long enough to miss. between the distant girls, the once tethered heart twice turned to stone, and I should have known, I should have known, 'cause it's too soon to be true, yeah. Set in stone, three chimes will be singing, baby. Throw care to the wind, like we have always been, and always had a promise, yeah. Maybe one day stop running, baby, and I should have known, I should have known, 'cause it's too soon to be, yeah, too late to be, oh, it's too soon to be true.
Quick interlude about one of the companies supporting this podcast. Ed, I think we can both agree that the best tasting songs are those that happen naturally.
That's true. Wait, you can't really taste a song though. That part's not.
That's also true of the food we choose to consume, which is why our favorite new artist on the healthy protein charts is ButcherBox. 100% grass-fed beef delivered on dry ice to your door anywhere in the lower 48.
So, does that make Alaska, like, the upper...
Ed, just open the box. If you're into more genres than just beef, ButcherBox has you covered. They also deliver Alaskan wild sockeye salmon, free-range organic chicken...
Wow, there's gotta be, like, 11 pounds of meat in here.
Heritage breed pork and special bacon.
Special bacon?
Special, because it's free. Use code SONGDIVERS at checkout to get $20 off and free bacon in your first ButcherBox. And... shipping's free too.
Special bacon and special shipping. That's special.
Now, can you grill as well as you can play guitar? Visit butcherbox.com to order. So we should say too, so you've played some shows with Mercy McCoy before. I should say we've got to play some shows with you before. Now that people have heard Monster Voice, which just sounds so freaking good. Oh, always has. And songwriting-wise, I think it's really interesting because I've known your stuff for a while. Actually, Eric Best, who's someone that we haven't really given a shout-out to
on here, man.
But we absolutely should, because Eric really was somebody that like really encouraged me and my best buddy Colin to go out and really pursue our current act, right? Our current Mercy McCoy group. And he actually helped us get some of our first gigs. And he's also the one I'm pretty sure hooked us up with you.
Yeah, man.
We met him through you. So, Eric, if you're listening, thanks so much.
Yeah, he put out a compilation.
Yes.
And that was like... such a huge, not only a compliment, but I was like, oh my gosh, look, there are tons of cool bands on this thing.
Yeah, it was like UNRB, Dan Field was on there,
yeah.
You were on there. And so that's how we really first got introduced to you. Like, we'd heard your name and you know, Eric had talked to us about you, but then when we went and heard, I think Runaways is the tune on that album, and it's just a monster song. It's so good.
That's super kind.
I think what's also very apparent to me in a lot of your songwriting, there's a lot of love and longing and working through relationships. So I wonder if you can talk to us a little bit about what's going on in that time, because you've been writing for what, maybe sounds like, what, 6 or 7 years of this kind of format.
Sure.
For a songwriter that is such an intimate songwriter, whatever you can share about your, like, what's going on in terms of your relationship with the world and how you're approaching relationships right now, and is that what's going into a lot of your songwriting?
I love that. Well, you are absolutely right. Love is, it's the universal language besides mathematics. Like, it is just, yeah, everybody wants and longs for love. Humans are communal creatures. We
social
want,
creatures.
Absolutely. We want to have community in some way, shape, or form. We find it in our friendships. We find it in our marriages. We find it in our, you know, I've got a friend of mine who was just asking me the other day, it's like, how do I just keep being promiscuous? But I'm like, you just do whatever you want to do. Like, but be mindful. Like, please be mindful. Don't just go out there for the sake of going out there.
I think to that, like, life's not black and white, right?
No.
There's
yeah.
so much gray, but there is dark and light.
Oh, absolutely. It's, and I think that, I love that you just said that. The absence of mindfulness is, if you're doing something and you're not being mindful about it, it's can be a very dark thing, because if you're just doing it very selfishly on for yourself and you're not thinking about the repercussions that come about because of what your actions project, then yeah, man, like you need to own that. You need to understand that that is a dark thing, or you just need to come to terms with it and try to find a balance and learn how to be more mindful. Like I said earlier, we're in a constant state of flux and understanding ourselves. And I think, like, if there was a word that would describe the last couple of years of my life, it would be mindfulness. Or yeah, it would be mindfulness. Just being more mindful of not just myself, but the people around me, how I affect the people around me, and how we can, and then turn, affect the people around us. So if we are not being mindful and we're just kind of like running around with torches and just setting things on fire, well, yeah, we're going to have a pretty shit life. Like, I mean, we're going to make other people's lives a bit shitty. A
lot of scorched earth.
Oh yeah, man. You can't burn those bridges all day.
There's the fire.
You'll be stuck on the island. Yeah. I told you I'm a pyro. but even, okay. So when it comes to the song that I just played, I think that I have such an interesting, we all do have interesting relationships with love. Like, we're trying to navigate it, trying to understand it, where it comes from, where it goes. Mm-hmm. I think our, now this may be a little off subject, but I think our concept of love is a bit abstract.
Seems pretty on subject.
Yeah. Hey, why not? But, you know, our individual concept of love, there's a communal aspect of love that we try to define. But it's been, within the last decade or so, it's been shaken. And I think that's really, really healthy. Because while we have, like, societal definitions of what love is and what love looks like, that's not always, we don't always fit within that societal mode. So our relationship with love, it ebbs and it flows. And a song like Too Soon, Too Late, that's pretty much what it is. Our relationship with love, are we too soon within this particular relationship? Did we fall too soon? Are we too much into this relationship that it's like, oh crap, I can't get out. Like, I'm like head over heels. Or did it, like, is it in our rear view right now? You know, is it behind us? Did we miss it? Is it the exit that I always seem to miss when I'm on tour? You know, mm-hmm. I just drive past it because I'm just not being mindful.
This is interesting too. Is it something that, like, you thought about and you're like, I need to put that in a song?
Or
is it like,
that,
I'm going through this while I'm writing it, it's coming out now?
It's a bit both and. Because, I mean, while my relationship with love has been relatively tumultuous, and again, love is a universal language. Mm-hmm. I think that as we start writing, now I don't know about you guys as songwriters, but as I start writing a song, sometimes I think more universal than I think specific. So I try to empathize mm-hmm. how someone else might be going through a particular thing, or how it might affect. And usually I parse those out in verses. Like, a verse will be something very personal to me, and then I'll go, okay, well, what about, like, the second verse? Like, maybe the second verse can go into a different direction if I'm not, like, just literally putting my heart onto a page.
Right.
So, yeah, it all depends on how the song comes out. But sometimes it's either me dealing with my relationship with love, or trying to empathize with somebody else, mm-hmm. trying to help meet them where they are, and singing and trying to bring some sort of solace.
So would you say Too Soon, Too Late is kind of like one of those songs where you're doing that?
Oh, yeah.
Kind of shifting from hard on the page to like a zoomed out kind of a...
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And I think it's... because a lot of people tend to... Because music is this incredibly subjective thing. We like to project our own meaning to songs. And I think that's really, really important. Like, I've had people, we talked about My Heart Wasn't Ready earlier, and they're like, oh, I love that song. I sing it to my husband. And I'm like, it's actually about my kid. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, no, did I ruin your experience with this song?
She's like, no, my husband's three.
Yeah. I'm not sure if you know this. Yeah. I mean, he acts like a three-year-old. Yeah.
And I look at some of your songs here, because I think one of the other ones off the new record, which we'll talk about here, we definitely want to get to the new record. So, like, Start Over, for example. Mm-hmm. But just having known you now for years... There's a, and I'm sure listeners can already tell from talking to you, but like there's a very forgiving nature to your personality, right? You are empathetic, and I can almost hear just the title Start Over, like in a conversation where you're with somebody, I can just see you be like, you know what? This didn't start like we meant. Let's just, I'm going to do you a favor. Rather than just have awkward, like I'm going to say it, like, let's just start over.
Yep. Yep.
We're good.
Yep.
Let's give it another shot.
That's literally what the song is. And it came about, thinking about the relationship that I have with my mom, because we had a falling out a couple of years ago, and I don't know, I was just being a dumbass, just being a selfish kid, I think.
So it was all you?
Oh, well, I will say yes. I will say yes for the sake of my mom maybe listening.
I'm not going to make
you publicly diss your mom. No, it's okay. It's all good. We are in a much healthier place now. Yeah. But just thinking of like the first verse is sitting on the front porch waiting here, you know, to beat the street light and head on home to you. Like being a kid, mom was like, you be home when that street light comes on, you know, scuff the feet hard on the rug, your arms wide open, hold on tight to you. I got my mama's heart, but my daddy's mouth.
Mm-hmm. It's a great line.
Thank you. It's one of my favorites. You and me weaving, like we're just going to fight. And my mom and I are a lot alike. We're very strong-willed, and we have our opinions, but we can work through things. And I think at the time of our fallout, it was just me not willing to work through or to be in a place of empathy, like understanding where she's coming from. And a few years down the line, especially writing songs, it's like remembering then, because I think we hit like a Mother's Day one time and we were just talking about this fallout. I'm like, I haven't thought of that in years. And so sitting in a car, just kind of remembering all of these things, these lyrics are coming to me. You know, what would you do? Let's just start over. I wasn't necessarily kind to you in this particular moment. Can we just start over and maybe we can fix the bad parts of this relationship? But then from there it extended to the universal aspect of going, okay, well this fits in relationally with our significant others. Mm-hmm. What does that look like? We have a bad start in our marriage. Can we start over on this? We had a bad start in our, you know, relationship as lovers. Can we start over on this?
I just flunked a test.
Yeah. Can we start over on this? Yeah. I literally Christmas tree'd this whole thing. Yeah. And that's kind of where it came from. So just the fact that you would, I take that as a compliment, just the fact that you could see and understand that. So, but yeah, again, it's our relationship with love and how we work through that. Can we start over? Can we hit the reset button?
Ah, you want to do that one for us?
Play. It would be interesting to do because I play it 100% different on guitar. I play it almost as like an Americana tune.
Do it up, man.
Sitting on the front porch waiting here, beat the street lights and head on home to you. Scuff the feet hard, let the dirt fly, arms swung open just to hold on tight to you. My mother's heart, but my daddy's mind. Let the words loose to be heard by you. You and me weaving while the winds are flare. Arms hung open just to hold on tight to you. Wanna start over? Start over, yeah, yeah. Let us start over, yeah, yeah. So we don't ever have to start. Just get over here, stand in my hand, just to offer them up to you, yeah. Flowers threaded through every lock of hair, arms swung open just to hold on tight to you. Red unwind, shackle my feet just to keep from leaving you. Wanna start over? Can we start over?
Tasty, yeah. Final chord.
Thanks.
There.
Thank awesome, you. Man. Yeah. So I play that when I play solo, I play it like that.
Mm-hmm.
But on the record, it has this like supremely soulful, sexy vibe that goes on. And what's funny
Barry
is
White.
That's how I've heard it since the very start.
Yeah, man. Yeah. We were talking about this before you got here. It's we should get into the new record because I am excited to talk about it. I know Ed is too. But it's. The record sounds great.
Thank you.
That was one thing we both were, like. We know your stuff. We really enjoy your songwriting. If anyone's seen you live, we certainly have. It's so much fun to see live because there's so much life to your voice. And you're generally solo. I'd say you're playing solo more often than you're playing with the band.
Yes.
And the band's great.
Thank you.
But your solo stuff, there's a lot of dynamics in the way you're playing too, which you can hear. But the record sounds like, yeah, like Barry White and Amos Lee got together.
Easy.
And we're like, let's do something real tasty.
I'll take that all day, man. That's a great compliment. Yeah.
Thank you. We were talking about it before you got here, and I was like, now that you're here and we're talking to you, and I hear that drums was like your first instrument.
Yeah.
Like, are you playing drums on this record?
On like a lot of the songs, I am.
Well, you played almost everything, right?
Yeah.
Which is incredible because it's, again, it sounds great, but everything's really tight.
It sounds like a great band.
Thank you. I make a great band.
What you're saying is when you play with yourself, you're at your best.
Oh, that's weird. Yeah.
That sure, came we'll out wrong. Yeah. What no, I meant to say.
Well, I followed.
Yeah.
Drums was my first love, and I played a lot of the drums on here. I did get some help from the guys in the band. We actually went back and recorded some of the other bass lines because my bass player, Andrew Glasgow, is a monster bass player.
I was going to say, you want to introduce the band real
quick? Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Damon Jeffrey Owens plays drums, and he is just incredible. One of the kindest, most smart-assy people I've ever met in my life. But just a sincere joy to be with and around. His musical language is incredible as well. Andrew Glasgow plays bass, and again, like I said, he's a monster bass player. He's also trying to teach me music theory right now, and it's like blows my mind how much knowledge is up in his head. Like, I mean, because he uses it too. It's not just like, oh yeah, like there's all of these seconds and sevenths and fifths and ninths and elevenths.
A really good bass player will use that.
Oh man, yeah. He is that, and he's tasty. He's not like gonna throw out all of these like weird runs or anything like that. He's just genuinely going to play these really smart bass lines. And same thing with John Hetherington, who's on keys. Again, incredibly intelligent when it comes to music theory, but just in the song. It's like if it doesn't need to be there, he's not going to play it. He literally feels that whatever the song needs in that moment, he will play on the keys. And he's like, he's been with me the longest out of all the guys. He's the guy who introduced me to Damon and Andrew. And I love the kid. He's
are
just
these
a great
all cats
dude.
That are down in Sarasota? Bradenton,
yeah, they're Sarasota? Just yeah, they're Sarasota jazz cats that are like literally tearing it up. Yeah.
That jazz background is so important. I think some of my favorite players locally, even if they're doing something totally different now, no, like when you find out later, like they have there's a jazz bass there.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
I think jazz forces you as a musician to learn music. You know, to learn the theory, to learn the vocabulary, to learn your instrument, and like,
and it's kind of almost paradoxical because there's an element of precision and tightness, but then you also have to be ultimately so loose.
Oh yeah,
and ready, you know, to adapt.
Yeah,
to
you're
the
so
other players.
Tight that you can loosen that thing up, and the moment that it needs to be, you're there.
Right.
Yeah, man.
How about electric guitar? I saw a video of a guy laying tracks on a Strat on one of the cuts. Is that a guy from the band? Or is
that's
that...
actually Adam Sliger. He's one of the producers
I was going to ask about that.
Of the
too.
Album.
Let's give a shout out to the studio. Yeah.
Studio is called Pioneer Sound in Castleberry, Florida, just a little north of Orlando.
Okay.
All good. It's Adam Sliger and David Whitmore, and those guys are like, they just know their stuff, and they're so chill and so relaxed, and their goal is to make whatever project that you are working on its absolute best. Mm-hmm. So they have tons of different genres of music that they're working on. They're not just stuck within, you know, whatever the hell I'm doing. Mm-hmm. They want a challenge, but they also want to make sure that they respect the art that they're making with you, and they want to make it its best.
Would you say you guys kind of co-produced
this
together?
Yeah.
So you came in, did you have a vision for every song and instrumentation and how you wanted it to?
So when I write, I write as a full band.
Mm-hmm.
Like as I'm playing it, I'm hearing other parts in it. I'm hearing piano parts, I'm hearing drum parts, I'm hearing how the rhythm is supposed to be. I'm hearing lead parts and backing harmony and all this other stuff as I'm playing it as a solo guy. But when we started recording, I had a vision for each one of the songs.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, they were all very, very loose. So we absolutely co-produced this whole thing. All of us did. There's a part in Start Over. It's just this line that kind of runs down the notes, and it's like a waterfall kind of
effect. Keyboard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Adam was like, I just hear this in there. I'm like, are you sure? I'm not really sure about it. And then he played it. I'm like, I don't know. And then I sat with it for like an hour, and I'm like, I can't not hear that in there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know exactly what you're talking about.
And that's, I think, this was my first experience like working with other people in a studio to carve this thing out. I did my first EP all by myself. I did two of the songs on the second EP all by myself. And then we went to Burnt Orange Studio in Bradenton to do the rest. We did it live and then just tracked everything else. And this one, we literally attacked each song because I work a 9-to-5 and I'm a dad and just trying to do my best. Once a month, we just focused on one song to try to get that song down to what it needs to be. A lot of parts were flown in. Like there are some string parts and there are some horn compositions. And those parts were flown in afterwards and put into the mix. Flown, by the way, sorry if you're listening, is they're just compositions done in other parts that are sent through the internet, the power of internet.
Interwebs.
And put into your sessions. Yeah. So like all the strings are done by Jack of All in Nashville, and they're just incredible. Like it's two violin cats that are, or violin and a cello, and they literally sound like a whole orchestration. Like it's just nuts how talented they are.
I was going to ask about that. The horns too. They were
So the horns, there are two composers for the horns. There are horns on Start Over, and there are horns on Too Soon, Too Late. Those were done by Dan Schaefer in Bradenton. He was in the band The Dram. And then the horns on Love You Better and We Ain't Never Been the Same were done by Ronnie D in Tampa.
Yeah.
You can kind of tell that Ronnie D did them because they're Ronnie D funky.
Yeah, we know Ronnie D.
Yeah.
So was that cut recently? Was it at All Access with Doug Johnston?
10 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Those were cut. So it's really still fresh. You can still, it still has that smell on it.
Yeah. Ronnie and Doug opened that studio up just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, man.
Like, and Doug's like a Grammy nominated.
Yeah, I know. That engineer. Trips me out.
Yeah.
He showed me a mix of something Ronnie was working on, and it literally one of the best mixes I've ever heard in my life.
Like, it's great.
Brilliant.
So is the album finished?
Finished. Mixed, mastered, awesome. Sent off to press. I'm expecting vinyl pressings to come in on Monday. To
CDs and vinyl?
Yep, CD and in. Vinyls.
And
digital.
Did it start life, not creatively, but as a Kickstarter?
No, like, that came later.
I was going to ask if
later
you
on.
Funded it. Through crowdsourcing, crowdfunding.
So when I started the project, everything I make in music stays in music.
Mm-hmm.
Like I work a 9-to-5 so that I can make sure my kids are provided for, bills are taken care of. So I was saving money from the solo shows and the 3-4 hour shows that you would do, the gigs that you, the, you know, those kind of gigs that you have to do to pay for that month's recording. And I would just build those up. And then whenever I had enough money, I would make the appointment. We would book it. I would make sure they get the money then, and like it's all taken care of. So I think we got about halfway through, and I realized, well,
it's
a couple
take
of
10 years.
Well, a couple of things. The first thing to kind of really turn into a crowdfunding project was I had to go in for surgery.
Oh yes,
and I had two disc herniations and two disc bulges that were pressing my spinal cord up against my spine, and I was losing feeling in my hands, dexterity. I wasn't able to play guitar as well. I was starting to lose feeling in my feet, and it was really freaking me out.
Was this from Ultimate Frisbee?
I was just going to ask. Yeah.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is called a callback.
Yeah.
No. Well, it very well could have. I don't know. I think it's just wear and tear. But I came to find out later, after having an MRI and actually having doctors look at it, that I have a degenerative bone disease.
Okay.
Didn't know that. Went in, had to have the surgery in January, and but before then, it was like, oh my gosh, like what am I gonna do? So I couldn't play drums anymore. So Damon came in. I couldn't play bass anymore. So Andrew came in. They were helping me out and just preparing for all of this stuff, and it takes time, you know. MRI take time, trying to book doctor's appointments, those things take time. So it just felt like I was living in this chronic pain of, you know, not being able to move my neck and losing my fingers and not being able to hold cups or, you know, anything. Like I couldn't pick up my kids, and that was the most, I was just emotionally painful. And so once I had the surgery in January of this year, 2019, being laid up in bed for a week mm-hmm. and not being able to go to work or anything like that. I was only in bed for a week. Like, I had to go back to work. Mm-hmm. It let me think about what does this look like musically? Am I going to be able to sing? Because the doctor was like, there's like a 1 in 1,000 chance that you'll be vocally paralyzed. It did scare the ever-living shit out of me. Because, especially when I asked him how many surgeries he did, and he was like, oh, it's 1 in 1,000. And he has already done 950 surgeries.
909.
And I'm like, yeah. So you mean it's 1 in 50 now? Yeah. Like, you haven't met that quota uh-huh. of 1 in 1,000. But he was
like, no, it was the second guy.
Yeah, he was like, no, I already got it. It was the very first one. Got it out of the way real quick.
But he wasn't a singer. Yeah.
but then like really doing research, and I think that messed me up before doing the surgery. Because I'm
Google
like,
is not dude, it's always like, your friend.
No, man, it's like WebMDing. What you have is a cold. You're like, I've got cancer. This is awful. You know. But just looking at the process, because it's a pretty hard process. You know, they take this medieval-looking contraption and they move your esophagus and throat over, and they get in there with their hands and do surgery. And that's what they did. And I'm like, okay, great. So I was playing it cool for the most part, kind of compartmentalizing how I felt about it mm-hmm. up until I was laying in the bed mm-hmm. for surgery that morning. And then it just hit me like a ton of bricks. I'm like, okay. I need to make peace with the fact that I may wake up and not have a voice at all. I need to make peace with not being able to sing anymore. I need to make peace with just however this is going to feel. And I do get vocally tired a lot quicker. And I have a shelf. Like, I'm finding that I can get past the shelf. But I think it's just, I'm 6 months, 7 months past surgery. And they gave me a year, like, you'll be mm-hmm. better in about a year. But I'm just, again, I'm much like my mother. I'm very impatient mm-hmm. and I'm hard-headed. So I just want to get it done. I want to get it done now. So having the surgery and going through all that and having to like really analyze how I felt about music and like what this is going to look like, the weekend before surgery, I literally went in and did all of the vocal takes for the remaining songs wearing a neck brace. And I'm like, this is just what I have to do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so finishing it was...
Congratulations, man. Oh, yeah. It's like 100% success.
Thank
like,
you.
Yeah.
It has... Yeah, it's making me happy.
Well,
and happier.
Things making you happy. Something that made me happy I want to share is about you. So
oh, please.
Recently, so I'd been watching on social, obviously, that you were going through the surgery, and then you were starting to get back out and gig a little bit. So you get out, you sing one song, test the water, see how it felt, mm-hmm. right? And then recently, you opened a show at Crowbar here in Ybor City Steven and Christian, guys from Amberlin and Acceptance. And I hadn't seen you since you'd had the surgery live. And so I was kind of nervous for you because I'd seen that you were kind of like, yeah, I'm kind of getting back out there. Like, I'm trying to get the endurance back vocally. And you just, like, brought the house down.
Ah, that's very
it was
kind.
No, and for everybody that was there, they were looking around like, this is awesome.
That show was actually very empowering because I think that was the very first show that I felt like I could go above that shelf that the surgery kind of like, I wasn't able to get above it. Like I couldn't, my falsetto wouldn't, I was stuck at this one note and I couldn't get over it where when I wrote it, there's a note over the shelf and I hit it that night and I went, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Like have I just walked away going, yes.
Have you ever done formal vocal training? No, but
I've literally been in talks with the last 2 weeks or so with people who are like, maybe you should think into like actually mm-hmm. doing some proper stuff so that you have good form
and
so that you're taking care of your voice.
And,
yeah. But I think there's something to say too for something to be said for the quality of a room that's behind you like that. You know, I thought that was
right.
And
the crowd,
Amberlin's fans are like that. You know, oh, they're a very supportive, loving group, and they've cultivated that. But that room was with you, and I didn't get the sense that everybody in there knew you either.
No,
you know? And it wasn't like it was a room full of Chris acolytes. But it was just people that loved what you were doing and were behind you and came open minded to hear that.
Yeah,
but.
And
but
I felt that.
That pushed you, you know? Yeah. And you're like, I'm going to do it. Like,
and that's totally
me.
Like where... That's exactly how I felt on stage behind the microphone. It was like, the first song always goes out and I have the jitters. And I'm like, oh, I just got to get them all out. Mm-hmm. And the first song, it usually just does that. I'm like, good. And after that song, I'm like, okay, I've still got a little bit of the jitters. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but they're with me.
Well, and I think we talk about feedback loops. Mm-hmm. I mentioned James and I, who's on the last... episode of this talked about how important it is to curate the people in your life that are hearing your songs and So not everyone's just telling you, like, this is great. And yeah. they can tell you, like, this is terrible. Or, yeah. like, that doesn't make any sense. Or that lyric is offensive, you yeah. know?
Or that lyric is
I'm offended by that lyric. But I think that feedback loop is so important because you... Ed was asking you about it, but getting to the point where you were doing a crowdfunding thing, to bring it back to that and talk yeah. a little bit about
no,
that.
Please.
Because you had to be very open about that, and you posted about it to try and get people to understand how important the record was and what it meant to you and how yeah. much you appreciated them, you know, supporting you.
Yeah.
That in itself is a really incredible feedback loop.
It really is. It really is. Because I think when
I... A quantifiable one.
Yeah, literally. I think when I first started, I didn't want to start it because, A, I feel uncomfortable asking for money. I just do.
Most people do.
And B, is it going to strengthen the community that is already kind of with me? Or am I going to find myself with $400 in my Kickstarter from my mom? You know, like, is that what it's going to look like? Am I going to identify with the outcome of this Kickstarter? And I didn't want it to be that. And I think that's why I was so open with it when I first came out and said, hey, I did it on a Tuesday. That Friday, the Friday beforehand, I was on a call with my friend Brian Sutherland, who's originally from Lakeland, moved to Nashville. Incredible songwriter, by the way. Just throwing that out there, like legit. Like Brian Sutherland's the man.
We'll look him up.
Please do. He pretty much just said, just do it. Like, just do it. Like, what do you have to lose? Like, genuinely, it's going to help you. There are no negatives here. Like, so what? You don't make it. So you don't make it. You don't get any money. That's fine. It just takes a little bit longer for the record to be done. But that was one of the most humbling things during the process, like when it first kicked off, is seeing the names come in and saying, they're supporting this? That's incredible. Because I never would have thought, or I didn't realize that they believed it. I mean, because we finished at like 122%. Like, that was just, I remember just crying in my room going, this is incredible. This is unbelievable. Like, this is the last thing I would have thought about. It did strengthen me in the end. But yeah, it was a heck of a just encouragement to see how many people and what kind of people and how broad, like where they came from, like Seattle and New York and California, Florida was huge. Like, it's just amazing to see where your music can go, even when you're not, even when you don't think it goes that far. Like, it really does have an extension and a life of its own.
Well, you might say people's kindness
never quits.
So do you want to talk a little bit about the title of the record?
Yeah. So I didn't have a record title when I first started doing this. I just wanted to make these songs and to see kind of what came about it. I think the original name for the record was like Start Over. It was just like a name of a song. And as we were recording these songs and feeling what the culture was doing, just socially and individually, there was just this supreme absence of... We've become a very reactive culture, which I think is important because of unmentioned things that are playing themselves out.
We know who he is.
Thanks. but just seeing how kind of divisive we've become. And again, we are human, we are fallible. All of us are able and prone to falling into, you know, these vitriol reactions. But being a reactionary person necessarily isn't always a good thing. It's good, but it's not always beneficial. If we can approach people, approach ourselves with kindness, no matter who they are, I'm not a big fan of the unmentionable person, but he's still a living being. And even though I don't
arguably
are, yeah, exactly. Depends on what he's filled with,
yeah.
Whatever's inside Twinkies.
Right.
There's still an amount of kindness that we need to hold because it's not just the reaction that we have towards things or people. It's also what we, how our reaction affects ourselves. Because if we allow ourselves to be continually reactive, it's going to change something in ourselves. And in my worldview, I would say it probably for the bad, because we can be better. But if we approach people, situations, circumstances, even ourselves with kindness, it will come back. It won't quit on us. It's not going to, it's not a fuel that will dissipate and just be gone. I ended up writing a song for it and about it that's pretty much just talks about it, and it opens up the whole album, just trying to set the tone of we can be immortal or we can die young. You know, we can drown in treasures or we can absolutely have none. We could be the poorest thing in the world, but you know, the one thing that we can remember in each one of our situations and circumstances is that kindness can be an extension of us, and it won't quit. It will come back.
Chris, you feel like doing another one? We don't want to strain you.
Let me try.
Yeah?
Let's
do it.
Why the hell not? You know, let's do Didn't Mean to Fall in Love.
Because we're at the end.
Yeah. Oh, okay,
we're
cool.
Going to kind of go out on
this is great. So. I don't have friends, so this is fun.
Well, Chris, before you play it, man, no, let us just say, dude, we love you. We love the stuff. We got to hear the tracks ahead of time. Thank you for sending those.
Yeah,
that's
we,
my privilege.
Made us that much more excited. For everybody listening, if you haven't seen Chris, go see him. You do yourself that favor. If you have seen Chris, you know exactly what we're talking about. And if you're a musician and you haven't got to do a show with Chris, I definitely recommend reaching out to him. Set
Please.
Something up, because if you want to have a show where you feel both extremely reluctant to get on stage after him, but also very motivated... or before him, absolutely. Thanks for all the times you've played with us.
Yeah.
All the future times, I hope that we will play with you.
Yeah,
all the
let's do it again.
Love, man.
It's gonna be
and,
fun.
And thanks for doing the show.
Thanks for having me.
One more question: do you have an official release date?
September 13th is it's out in the world. Pre-sale is August 30th.
And are you gonna do like a release party?
You know, I tried to set one up, but with all the spinning plates, it just became a bit too anxious and hard. So I'll probably plan something for before the end of the year.
Maybe Songdivers can host one for you.
I like what you're saying.
Yeah.
I like what you're saying. Yeah, man, it'll be fun. We'll play through the whole record.
Well, Chris, thanks again, man. Congrats on the record.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, dude, we'll do it again soon.
All right, this is Didn't Mean to Fall in Love.
Never saw you coming. Tried too hard to move along, but I found myself at the start. Knew I should have got my heart. Knew I should have known better. Didn't mean to fall in. Didn't mean to fall in love. It's too late to hide it. Let's not unwind. The tether is tied and we'll figure it out, yeah. It's too late to hide it. Don't try to fight it. I don't know how, but we'll figure it out. We'll figure it out, yeah.
Been listening to Song Divers.
Thank you for supporting us and our sponsors and all the great independent music makers out there trying to make their way in the music business these days. Songs we heard in this episode are Love You Better, Too Soon, Too Late, Start Over, Didn't Mean to Fall in Love, and Kindness Never Quits.
To hear more of Chris's full catalog, head on over to iTunes, Spotify, and all the places you go to get your music on. To keep up with Chris, check out ChristopherJamesMusic.com. Christopher is with a K, K-R-I-S-T-O-P-H-E-R. And make sure you keep up with Chris on his especially social media, Facebook, Instagram, and all the rest of the interwebs. And if you like what we're doing, it'd really mean a lot to us if you could rate us and give us a review over on iTunes or whichever platform you're getting your podcast from.
Peanut butter, what do they call them? Dongs?
Kongs.
Dongs.
Peanut butter
Kong divers.
Dong
divers.
Kong
divers.
Dong Kongs and yeah. Song divers.
Donkey Kong diver.
Song Divers is a production of Ybor City Records and recorded in the historic Kenwood district of St. Petersburg, Florida.